God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. Please feel free to unmute yourself and say hello.
Hello, hello.
Brian, yes. Welcome.
Thank you.
Anybody else? First 30 days? All right, we'll throw some of the men will throw their numbers in the chat for you, Brian. Anybody else? Feel free to unmute. Going once, going twice. All right. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting tonight is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to have Jim H. from Rancho Santa Fe, California. He's going to tell his story. And after he does that, somewhere around the top of the hour, we'll take a short break and call for some announcements, pass the seven tradition basket, et cetera, and give Jim a little break. And then we'll reconvene for the last half hour of the meeting, and we'll just ask whatever questions that you submit throughout this meeting. We don't have any questions in the can. Just as you think of questions, please send them to the user questions and we'll interview Jim. It's a lot of fun. It's a quick hour and a half, and I don't want to take up another minute of Jim's time. I'm very excited to hear. Thanks for coming tonight, Jim. Welcome.
My pleasure entirely, David, and thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Jim, an alcoholic, and just terrific to be with you. David and I were chatting, maybe some of you heard, one of the very few attributes of the COVID pandemic that's ravaged so many people and the world is that we've discovered Zoom and through it have the opportunity to be with so many people we probably never would have encountered before, and or if not for COVID. So I'm grateful for it, and get some details out of the way. I have a sponsor. His name is Perry C. Perry Cross, who, by the way, is recovering from COVID at 92. After 3 months in the hospital. God bless that guy. He's just a wonder. I have a home group. It's just the Black Print Book Study here in Rancho Santa Fe, just northwest of San Diego, for those of you who, it's a little rural community or semi-rural community just northwest of San Diego. And that is the meeting that started in 1973 that Ray J probably talked about, 1973 in Los Angeles. And after Jennifer and I moved here 9 years ago, I waited a year, but I had to have that meeting here. I had been going to it for many, 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 many years since I was 2 years sober. And I just had to have it. It was a book study and it was the a vehicle that launched me into a love affair with the big book. So I had to have it, but I waited a year or so that they wouldn't think I was a carpetbagger out here, and then got a bunch of guys to help me start the meeting, and we started with seven people, and we get 60 now or so, and it's just a wonderful meeting. And if you ever get in this area, and you don't call and get my number from David and come over and meet with us, then we'll have the authorities stop you from leaving the area. My sobriety date is May 13th of 1973. So in a couple of months, I hope to be blessed with 48 years of sobriety. I must say at the top that my gratitude for living a sober life in Alcoholics Anonymous is just bottomless. It is the by far the greatest thing that ever happened to me, or I think ever will happen to me. So, it's a real privilege to be in Norfolk and the Tidewater Basin. I think they still call it that. I was in the Navy there, and I may have a couple of stories about it. And let's see, it's 7 o'clock there. I think probably you're seeing, or maybe have already seen the last rays of the sun there. We have some to go here. It's a beautiful afternoon after starting out cloudy. And we're all lucky to be wherever we are and sober. It takes 8 minutes for a ray of light to come from that cauldron of the sun to the earth. And it makes me think of unity when I think of you there and me here, and we've been blessed by the same sun and the same sobriety under the same principles that we embrace in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's just a thrill. I always like to know something in general about the guy or gal that's in front of me. And my wife and I, Jennifer, have been married next month. We'll be married 35 years. I got the brass ring on this marriage, folks. She's just tremendous. She's a well-known impressionist painter, and we have a fantastic life together. In what seems like will probably seem like 30 seconds, in October I'll be 84. So I've had a long, beautiful stretch of life in sobriety. I have a daughter that's 58 years old and 3 grandsons who refuse to live the way I think they should. You know how grandkids are. But anyway, it's a great life here, and I'm just so fortunate. I was born in Northeast Iowa, in Waterloo, Iowa, and there was a joke about that. I think it was George Gobel or Johnny Carson that said that Iowa is so flat in that part of the country that you can watch your dog run away for 3 days. And I've always loved that little description of it, but it's a beautiful part of the Midwest. So I'm a son of the American Midwest, and I was the second of 9 children. 4 of us are or were admitted alcoholics, and if I may say so, there are another 2 that are not admitted but highly likely to qualify one of these days, hopefully. So probably 5 of the 9 of us lost the roll of the genetic dice and got and were alcoholic. I'm a writer by profession, and a journalist, and I just toss in here that both of my grandfathers were alcoholic, so it was almost presumed that we had the seeds of it in our blood. I have a new book coming in this summer that contains a story about my grandfather called The Broken Day of Bernie McCarville. And I mention it because my grandfather at 35 was drunk and ran a team of horses and himself into a freight train in Waterloo in 1915 and was killed and left to his wife, my grandmother, and his four kids, including my mother, destitute. And so he sort of laid the path in some senses for the alcoholism that has visited our family. I'd like to talk about the illusion of control tonight that we are visited by so frequently and so destructively in our drinking careers. This defect surely played a major role in my own drinking and can also torment me in sobriety. I've had visits from it lately, the last 3 months, as my daughter suffered from her second breast cancer and some complications from the surgery. And one of my brothers, other brothers who's sober, one of the sober ones, has gratefully emerged from a very dangerous heart surgery at Mayo Clinic last Monday. So I'm extremely grateful for that. And in the middle of that, one of my other brothers, who's probably a suspect, confided in me that he has a cancer of the bile duct, and that's a really, really dangerous diagnosis. But so these illusions of control, I wish it didn't happen. I wish I had something to do with curing these people or making them feel better or alleviating their pain or anxiety. And I can't except to be a good brother. So those illusions of control can disappear because in a rather quick order, because I've been taught by my sponsors in this book here that I can deal with them by applying my AA principles. What the illusion of control does to me, I guess, or does that when I experience it without working these steps of ours, is that it robs me of being in the moment. It locks me into the sense that I can somehow can change the past and design the future. And that's a useless and dangerous compulsion. I think you probably recognize it from your own lives. But right now, this is the time I love most, because I'm here with you in the moment, and I feel like this is what you give me in being in front of me. And I've learned to try to give some of that back over these years. And that gives me freedom. That gives me a freedom outside the illusion of control that is wonderful. when I was drinking from the very first drink, I thought I had experienced freedom. And from there on, I sought that freedom, that what Dr. Silkworth calls the sense of ease and comfort that comes with the first drink. And I interpreted that as freedom. But what I really had was the freedom of the damned. And it took me years and years of remorse and pain and resentment and envy, suspicion and distrust to find out that that was the freedom of the damned and not any real freedom in any sense of the word. I began to feel that compulsion as a boy growing up in Iowa, even before alcohol completed its hijacking of the reward centers in my brain and rendered me powerless over it and gave me no real way out until I came here to you. You're familiar with this drill, of course. My first sense of ease and comfort with alcohol came when I was still a teenager. My grand aunt had died, and my great uncle called me down to his house to help pack up her collection of porcelain elephants. And we sat there and wrapped these porcelain elephants in newspapers and put them in boxes. And at one point, my Uncle Leo said, "Let's take a little break." And he brought out two shot glasses and a bottle of Old Granddad. And he said, "Let's toast your aunt." He called her Tootie. "Let's toast your Aunt Tootie." And he poured his and poured mine, and I watched him. I was going to model myself after him. Here was an adult making me feel like an adult. And I watched him top his down, and I topped mine down, and boom, that sense of ease and comfort came to me for the very first time. And I looked for it, ached for it, and then demanded it for every single drink I took from then on. So I had the idea that this changed everything for me, that put me in greater control, which was sort of the beginning of that illusion. And that camaraderie and that feeling like an adult was wonderful. Count the times that you can find this illusion of control in my life under the mantle of alcoholism, which instead of making me rise, pushed me down into what the book calls the gates of insanity and death. I was a very poor student in high school, and I was always looking out the window for something easier and better. I didn't seem to fit the world. I just didn't feel like I was part of it. I lived in fear and in constant demand for praise and recognition when I did really nothing to merit it. And I couldn't get enough of praise when it did come. And I hated people. I hated my older brother because of his academic achievements, his skill in math, and for stealing my girlfriend. Guy was merciless, just took her right out from under me. Carolyn Houlihan, oh my God. So I was already addicted to the idea of alcohol, and I drank it whenever I could get it, beer and steel drinks after my parents' parties. When high school graduation finally came, my dad wanted to know what I was going to do. And we were sometimes poor and not by any means wealthy when my dad did bring paychecks home. And the family was growing rapidly, as I said, into 9 children. Seemed like every 12 months, another little Catholic would pop out. And I just, you know, the house was getting crowded. My dad just, he expected us to move on and support ourselves. So I told my dad I wanted to be a radio and television reporter. And he looked at me and grimaced and said, "Well, if you're going to do that, you better learn to cut hair or something so you'll have something to fall back on." Having zero self-confidence myself, I let him pop that balloon for me, and then I was stranded without any ambition. And I found ways to drink, and I liked where it put me because I wouldn't hurt so much from what I felt was a rejection of my dad and of the world. Then I hit on one of my first brilliant alcoholic ideas. I needed recognition badly. I was aimless. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I had to get out of the house. And I was a Catholic boy who I had religion only in the sense that an actor has a role to play for a public audience. And of course, I had no spiritual life because I was so inward bound in the way I thought about myself and this illusion of control that I had someday I will be able to master my destiny. And so I went into the Catholic seminary in Dubuque, Iowa. And I was a very poor student there, and I was always still looking out the window and learning Latin and philosophy and logic and so on, and I was extremely poor at it. My roommate and I both liked to drink, and we found ways of making that possible for ourselves. We both worked in the cafeteria as a side job, and so we'd bring oranges home back to the seminary after breakfast, and we'd collect them. And then I'd ask my mother to send me a juicer, one of those glass juicers. And then we conspired to bribe a non-seminarian to bring a bottle of vodka to the back of the seminary building and tie it to a piece of fishing line that I had put down from our third story window with a washer on it, a weight on it. And while we were at meditation at night, if you compare that meditation to what I try to do now, it's like a feather in the wind, but we were meditation. We'd meditate at night. And then after meditation, we were required to observe grand silence, which means that you don't talk until after Mass the next morning. No speaking, no talking, rigorously monitored. And then we'd go up after meditation, night prayers and meditation, and we'd pull that vodka up from down there behind a bush, and we'd squeeze the oranges and make screwdrivers. And we would drink them until we were passed out drunk. But here's the thing, I was forming this double standard about life, about this illusion of control. And so we drank till we pulled vodka up from behind to violate all the rules and drank till we were passed out, but we never spoke. We never spoke, so we were obeying outward rules, but none of the real rules of living. So I didn't do too well there, and I'll only say this. During that 2 years, some terrible things happened to me in there. I was sent to a place where I was drugged and raped. I couldn't understand that, especially coming from the representative of God on earth and so on and so forth. So I just had to drink even more to bury that. And I hated the church. I hated everybody. I hated anybody that wanted me, that urged me to be spiritual and religious and obey the rules of the church and so on and so forth. So I left the seminary. I actually got kicked out for drinking, but it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I knew that they were serious about no girlfriends, you know, or no, none of that. And I didn't belong there. I was a complete orphan in the sense that that I should have a vocation of any kind to enter the religious life, but it was what I did to get recognition and praise. And I got plenty of that for 2 years old. Jimmy, I'd go home and they'd, oh, just so wonderful. But I couldn't feel that inside at all. So I left the seminary and I had started writing. The only thing that ever made me think that I had something of value of it by myself was that I could write a little bit. And so I left the seminary and went to the nearby college and studied journalism and writing. And I started to have some success all the while drinking with my classmates. I was the co-editor of the Literary Quarterly on campus, and I won a bunch of writing awards. I was thought to be a upcoming writer and so on, but that didn't help me find myself, because alcohol was turning me so much inward and into so much penetrating fear that I couldn't see myself either as I really was. And that's a problem that took me down a long road of terror and pain, that I could never see myself as I really was until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsors took me through these steps. I've outlived three sponsors. And they were, every one of them, a complete blessing in my life, because they took this book and caused me to fall in love with it. And I'm deeply in love with this book. I still am. I'll pause here and show you. This is where the guys come into my study here and sit down take their beatings. and there's a place where the guy sit, and this is the great joy of life is being able to do what we're asked in the book. You know, you've seen this, of course. The book says that talks about amends and so on and so forth, and it says, but this is not an end in itself. And then it tells us what our real purpose is. It says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum benefit to God and those people about us. This is going to go off. This is going to go off in a second. I saw on the notice of sponsee, but anyway. But so So I but at that point I couldn't know that, and I couldn't see anything true about myself. So I went on through the next 2 years of college, and it was pretty successful. But during that time, I had my first blackout. And I know I'm spending a lot of time about my early alcoholism, but it's important to me. And I'm sure yours is to you, because it's the foundation for what we go back and reveal to ourselves and to our sponsors when we're doing our fourth and fifth steps. And to some great extent, our eighth and ninth steps. So some of the journalism students were invited to be assistants or be mentored at the local newspaper called the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we had I was one of them, and we had a city editor by the name of Mark Dollinger. He was a beaut. He had always had his tie undone, and he smoked unfiltered Camel cigarettes out of the side of his mouth. And was always in there, and he'd talk out of this side of his mouth. He was a rough, tough guy, and we modeled ourselves after him. We were going to be journalists like him, and rough and tough. He hit him hard. And one night he took us to the bar down the street, and we sat up at the bar and had sawdust on the floor and sat up at stools, and we drank. We looked at him and modeled ourselves after him, just like I modeled myself after my uncle in that room. And he drank peppermint schnapps with a beer chaser. Holy moly. But we did it. We did it anyway. And it wasn't too long before I just felt that sawdust floor coming up at me. And over I went. And all I remember after that is waking up in Mark Dollinger's apartment with his girlfriend holding my head in her lap, and everybody telling me that we were just about to call the ambulance. There were no paramedics in those days, of course. And good God, Jim, something's really bad has happened to you. You probably can't drink, and you've got to really be careful, man. Wow. And all I thought of was it was romantic. Here my head was in her lap. She was giving me coffee and so on. I thought that was pretty wonderful. I probably would write about it in a book someday. There you are for the illusion of control again. But I went off graduated from college and went off to the officer's candidate school in the Navy. That's what brought me to Norfolk. And I flunked out of officer school because I had resented my brother over math, and I flunked out on navigation. You have to be able to navigate a ship at sea if you're an officer in the Navy, and I couldn't do it. So I had good marks and everything else, but I got kicked out. So I big humiliation for me. But so what? We went off base and drank, and we smuggled alcohol into the base against the rules again, and I went on my merry way to Norfolk, Virginia, where I was placed as a journalist in the seaman journalist in the headquarters of the Atlantic Fleet there. Some of you know where that is. And that's where NATO is, and so NATO headquarters of Atlantic Fleet and so on. And I got a good job there, and I started to do radio broadcasts and for NATO and write things for a daily radio show on WCMS there. I don't know whether it still exists, but so on. So, and then one day, but I continued to drink. And by the way, in the meantime, I went home, married my college sweetheart, who was the editor of her literary quarterly, at having no capacity for any relationship at all. Everything was a contract. If I do this, you should do that, or an agreement. You keep off my back about my drinking, and I'll keep off your back about your poor pay as a teacher or whatever it is. And so I was drinking, and I thought very successfully. And one day, NBC Radio asked us to do, for permission to do a series of interviews aboard the first nuclear Polaris submarine that was up there in New London, Connecticut, you know where that is. And we told them they couldn't do it because it was, all of it was top secret. So I thought, here's my genius idea again. I thought, well, what if I do it? I'm experienced. I was 21, I don't know. And what if I do it? And I had all the clearances. I had a top secret US and a NATO cosmic top secret and so on, blah, blah, blah. I don't know why. I certainly didn't have any qualifications for it, but I could keep a secret. So anyway, I went to NBC, the host of Monitor said, oh yeah, great, let's do it. David Garraway was his name. And so a few weeks later, I went down to New London and my recorders went aboard that submarine. And I thought, listen, this is a big deal. This is NBC Radio, audience of 3 million people at that time, so on and so forth. This is going to be a big deal. I'll bet you $20 they're going to have a drink for me on that ship. And I went, that's why I took the train down there. And I thought, yeah, then I drank on the way down, of course, and before I got aboard, there was no alcohol in that sucker. And all 386 feet of it, not a drop of alcohol. Oh my God. We went out in the early evening and dove and didn't come up for 14 days. And here's old Jim without a drop of alcohol. And I don't know how I made it. I don't know. I made a bunch of interviews. I was, I thought they were pretty good. And they eventually aired 20 or 17 of out of the 21. So I felt pretty good, but there's no alcohol. On the way back in, we docked at Cape Canaveral, and what was then Cape Canaveral, and as we were out to sea approaching Cape Canaveral, I asked the captain if he would upscope. We hadn't surfaced yet, and he probably thought, well, he wants to see the panorama of the sea once more, and so on. Well, what I was looking for was a bar on shore, and he put the scope up and I looked through there, and by God, I found one just to the other, the east of the Cape, with a Budweiser sign, a big Budweiser sign lit up in it. Oh God, I felt such relief. And I couldn't wait to get ashore, and I went over there and drank three quick frosty Budweisers, and then got on the train, bought a bottle of bourbon before that, and got drunk and abused a poor young girl on there. Then they stopped the train and kicked me off at the first junction. So here's the NBC News reporter, big, big deal. Deprived of alcohol for 14 days, resentful. And then they kicked me off the train, but I still wasn't humiliated because I had the illusion of control. And so, and my adventures in the Navy went on, and I got out of the Navy and I enrolled in graduate school out here in California, and I went, took my wife, and by the way, I left this out. I have to tell you this because this is in my first four step, I could hardly write this. This is one of the greatest acts of self-obsession that I ever committed. My wife had a miscarriage, and we got pregnant again. And one day I was sitting with my beer watching television, and she started a hemorrhage, and I ran her down the steps to the bottom layer of this house, bottom floor of this house. It was on Gosnold Avenue. Does anybody recognize that? Yeah. And I brought her down the sidewalk, down another set of steps, and put her in the car, went around to got in the car, and realized I didn't have my beer. So I went back out of the car, up the steps, up into the second floor, got my beer, came down, got in the car, put it between my legs, and drove her to the hospital. Now that, my friends, is insanity. That is beyond any the pale of anything that a human being who had any semblance of morals or respect or dignity to do. So it was one of the first, it was when that came to me, having been compressed down into the depths of my consciousness, and when that came to me in the fourth step, I just about fled. So I went, came to California then, and went to graduate school, and I needed to work, so I got a job in downtown Los Angeles, paid $117.56 a week, whether I needed it or not, and I needed it. We needed it badly. And I found some success there while I drank and continued to corrode the terminals of my thoughts and actions. You know this as well as I do. It's alcohol is like acid eating away at its own container. It just keeps eating and corroding the mind and the body. And I the first day I went to work at this place, they took me to a Mexican restaurant where they had we drank beer and had tortillas for the first time and so on. I thought it was heaven. But I kept going downhill, and eventually I was arrested 3 times for drunk driving. I spent a couple of nights in jail and then was bailed out, and I still had the illusion of control that this is really something of just a matter of bad luck. And that that it would probably not reoccur, but it did. And after 8 years in that job, they kicked me upstairs because I was always drunk, and I had thrown away all the principles I had learned as a boy, where I was taught. That included fidelity to a marriage, responsibility in my job, obeying the laws, being a civic citizen of any kind. And after 9 years, I was offered a job to make films at a studio called Vanguard in Hollywood, and I jumped at it because he would give me complete freedom to drink, and it would take me out of that shameful area of having been kicked upstairs in this job because I was drunk all the time. So I took that job and I started to make these films and so on. And I kept drinking and drinking and getting in trouble. And I told David at the beginning of the meeting, one time I was making a little short film, a trailer film for Lucille Ball's terrible version of Annie Mame. And I never met her because I saw her, but I didn't meet her because I was kicked out of there for being drunk. And it just kept going on. And then one day, my bosses, his name was Charlie Palillo, and his wife ran this studio, and they told me that I was drinking too much. I had to stop, or else, you know how the book Jim and Fred talk stories talk about pills and so on. And I was terribly upset about this and resentful about it. And I thought again, it was a intermeshing of circumstances, and look at all the great work I had done and so on. And so it kept going on that way. And I was finally confronted with this idea that something was wrong with me, but I kept going on. And I was making a film about a little documentary film about, by the way, none of it's just what I do. There's like my sponsor reminds me, you're not what you do. It was just what I did, and you're not going to find any of these films on any Academy Award nominee list or anything like that. I didn't come even close to David Wolper in making documentaries. But one day I went down to make this film about the Arco Towers, then the tallest buildings in Los Angeles. And I told my film crew that this was going to be rehearsal for the topping off ceremony, where they take the last girder up to the top of the building, you know, and then they have flags on, a California flag, American flag, and everybody makes speeches and all this. And I said, now I want you guys to be on time and no Hawaiian shirts, no t-shirts, look great. And I'll see you down there because I've got a meeting. Well, my meeting was over at the Nicodelle Bar in Hollywood. And I went over there and had three or four drinks with my contacts over there, and realized that I was late, and sped downtown to Los Angeles, threw some money at the parking lot attendant, went over to the building, and people were there in their hard hats, the governor, the mayor of the city, and so on and so forth. They had the hard hat on, so they were tapping their feet, waiting for me. We got on this cage elevator on the outside of buildings. You know what that is. It's just an elevator that goes up on the outside for construction workers. And I got into that elevator with them, reeking probably of alcohol. And there's a point, folks, you know this, when our last thread of control over alcohol separates and breaks. And that happened on the way up that elevator to the top of that building. Way, way up there, 50 stories or whatever it was. And when the cage elevator opened and onto just girders and plywood and some ropes along the side, I had become totally insane. And I jumped out in front of everybody and started framing shots the way a producer does. And I was just on these plywood planks in the middle of nowhere. That did it for my boss, and he told me, we have to go over and talk to somebody. And we went over to one of my favorite bars at the Hamburger Hamlet, and he said, I'm going to call Dick Age. Dick wouldn't mind this. Dick Hoffman was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I used to drink with at the Press Club, the Greater Los Angeles Press Club. And of course, when my boss said, I'm going to call him, what was I going to say? And Dick came over and he said, Jim, can you put that scotch aside and talk to me a little bit? I said, okay. Of course, I was completely bombed. And he said, look, I have a problem that I've found a solution to, and I think you have the same problem. And I want to help you with this. Will you go to an AA meeting with me? And I thought, oh my God, one of those? I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but like a lot of you, I thought it was just a group of ne'er-do-wells from the streets that couldn't find their way out of their bottle of bourbon in a paper bag. And I said, okay, what are you going to say to the highway patrol, to your boss, to your wife? What are you going to say? Sure, you'll say, because you want to get the pressure taken off. So I went to the meeting with him. I insisted on driving myself there. I'd meet you there. And I went there and I walked in and looked at these guys. And a guy by the name of Keith Carpenter was giving his first talk, giving a talk, and so on and so forth. And I was half listening and wanting to get out of there to drink again. After the meeting, people were giving me meeting directories and telling me which meetings I should go to and so on. And I was going, you know, the language of the untreated alcoholic, yabba-dai, 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 such and such. Yeah, I know where that is, such and such. And a guy came up behind me that I couldn't see and said, shut up. They're trying to save your ass. And I turned around. It was a guy I hadn't met before, but his name was Clancy. And so I went home and took a book with me and mixed a drink and sped, read the big book in bed, and then passed out. And then I went into Good Samaritan Hospital eventually, weighing 116 pounds and dying. And I was in ICU, and the last person I'd ever want to see came into the ICU, a Catholic priest by the name of Father Terry. And Father Terry asked me if I could, he could look at my medical record and hanging on the end of the bed in those days. And I said, yes, Father. He looked at it, he says, there are a lot of things wrong with you, aren't there? And I said, yes. He said, do you think there's anything wrong with you that's not on this list, on this medical record? And I said, God, I hope not, Father. What do you mean? So he 12-stepped me. And he told me that he had a solution, just like Dick did, to my problem, if I could find a way to acknowledge that I had the problem in the first case. Went on, he told me later he thought it was the best 12-step call he ever paid. I was sent home from the hospital after 14 days with a prescription for Librium and Tylenol, a antidepressive and a sleeping medication. And I started to take those times two and then times three, because I could be sedated with it, but I eventually knew I wanted to return to my drug of choice. But I didn't. Another AA, a couple of other AAs gave me a phone call, and they came over and took me to my first meeting, to my second meeting. And that was what turned the tide for me, because I found suddenly what I had thought I sensed in that ICU with Father Terry, and that was this, Raymond Rosalie, the poet, one of my early teachers, called it a wand of light. I just couldn't forget it. But when Father Terry had left, I felt a fear, and a new kind of fear. And what I've discovered is that fear was the fear of a new power, that new power might be greater than I was. But I didn't want to contend with that, because I still had that illusion of control. But I started going to meetings, and I started to... And I got an assignment to wash the ashtrays after a meeting. And by God, if you ever imagine the aluminum ashtrays crusted with ashes and then soap and water, it's the worst smell. I'd rather smell a cadaver again than that smell. But I did it because it made me feel that I was with somebody and some people that might help me. I had found what the book calls a way out. And that's what has fired me in all these years since. And I began to be sober. And I took my first faltering fourth step. I've taken many fourth steps, or fifth steps, I should say, fourth and fifth steps. And I've taken many eighth and ninth steps. To my wife, to my daughter, whom I essentially abandoned when she was a little girl. And I found these steps to have a sense of redemption that is very close to the meaning of the word, that have brought me light and acknowledgement and searching. And it's been a fantastic trip. I regained my career. I had a long business career grounded in writing. And then after that career, I had a very fortunate outcome from that career. And then I began, I formed with another member of AA who happened to be my friend, and another fellow, wonderful fellow from New York. I formed a consulting firm, and all this while, these guys kept coming into wherever I was. We sold our house in Hollywood Hills and came out here 9 years ago. And when I say I had a successful career, now this marriage, as I've said, will be 35 years next month. When I say all that, I say at the same time, and I hope it resonates with you, that there's been nothing in my life that I could have had or experienced or tasted or smelled or sensed in any way, physical or emotional, that could have happened without Alcoholics Anonymous. And these guys that come in and sit in here and have come into wherever I was for a long time benefit from that. But what I tell them is, and this is really critical, what I tell them is when we start with a new fella or somebody that's never been really through the book before, I tell them when we're finished with this work, neither of us will ever be the same again. And that is completely true. It's validated itself time and time and time again. I now have such a wonderful life. I've always had a wonderful life of outside of my practicing alcoholism. And I, Jennifer and I just have a wonderful time. But my life is devoted to service, and that has in it what there used to be a pop psychology phrase, I think in the 70s or 80s, called enlightened self-interest. A strange phrase, but I can apply it to Alcoholics Anonymous, because the enlightenment of sobriety gives me the tools for what amounts to self-interest, because I get it all back. In magnified senses of the word, and it's are there, have I suffered pains and death and suffering and loss of family and loss of sponsees to alcoholism? Yes, of course, that's part of it. And these are the vicissitudes of life that visit us all if we are alert to them. And the contrast between pain and sorrow tells us that we need one, need both of them to have the joy and satisfaction of life, doesn't it? And so it's been wonderful, and I think I'm almost out of time here, but this has been a journey that constantly reminds me of what the poet James Hurst said. He said, "The connection with a thing is the only real truth I know," he says, the connection with a thing. And here we're connected, and we can stay out of that basement where we're going through these old albums, paging through them, blowing the dust off them and saying, "What could have been," the two most useless words of the English language, "what if," and we're trying. That's the one part of the illusion of control. And then I go up into the attic where there's a genie with a crystal ball, and I want to know the future. Those are the two parts of my brain that I like to visit the most. But I'm here. Now I'm here in the moment as you are, and I love you for that. There's nothing like Alcoholics Anonymous on the face of the earth. There's nothing like a life of sobriety anywhere that I know of. And working with others is the salve that heals all wounds, the wounds of sorrow, wounds of self-obsession, wounds I've given, wounds I've received. They're all comforted by Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know you have that same sense when you open your hearts to another alcoholic. And you recall those thrilling words that still make me cry. Sorry. And that is, somewhere every day, every moment, one alcoholic talks to the other, carrying the message of recovery, experience, strength, and hope. And that's what I hope you'll always have. And I trust that God will give it to you. And you need God, you need a higher power. We need, whatever the definition of that higher power is. I know someone who was a truck driver who would drive off his 18-wheeler off in the desert at night and turn off his lights and find his higher power. Whether you find it there or wherever you find it, God, as the ancient philosopher said, God is a name that we give to that in which we move and breathe and have our being. That's all we need. It isn't something that is unavailable to any single man or woman. Wonderful to see you, and God bless you and keep you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. That was amazing. I'm going to allow everyone to unmute and say thank you. There you go.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. That was great.
Thank you so much. Thank that was you. Awesome.
Thank you very
thank
much,
you, Jim.
Thank you, sir.
Jim, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
My privilege, folks. A joy to see you.
All right. I'm going to take the meeting back for the moment, and we'll give Jim a break, and we'll do a little business here. I've placed a link in the chat for the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Before I read the rest of that card, I'm just reminding everybody that the user questions, it's really Larry. He's sitting there waiting for your questions that you might like to ask Jim when we reconvene. So please do that. Back to the card. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition states the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? I'll take just a few by show of hands. I'm gonna allow you to unmute. Come on, Ebony, I know you got one.
Hey, y'all, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. Yes, I do. The Virginia Area Committee Spring Assembly is happening next Friday through Sunday, March 19th through the 21st. Friday night, we'll be having our committee meetings. If you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the state of Virginia, you are welcome. It is an open meeting. There's some great conference concern discussion happening, fifth editions of a big book, a possible workbook, changing the language and sponsorship and questions and answers about sponsorship. There are so many topics being discussed. Your voice is very important. We want to hear from you. And so if you have any questions, you can reach out to me. I'll put my info in the chat. That is, once again, Friday the 19th through the 21st. It is free registration online, being held virtually through Zoom. And if you would like to register, I'll also put that info in the chat as well of how you can. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Ebony.
Thank you, Ebony.
All right, anybody else? Announcements? All right, the Simple Actions Group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, please feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right. So I see just a couple of questions trickling in. Please feel free to get some questions over there to Larry. And Jim, thank you so much. That was just amazing. Our first question is, what is your favorite step?
Well, that's hard to say. It's like, what's my favorite child? But I think step eight and nine, if I can couple them together, are my favorites because they are so effective at putting me in a frame of mind where I can not only make amends for the past as it comes up, but put myself in the position of someone who can help others in the 12th step. If I have a succinct and accurate memory of the harms I've done to others, without the remorse and guilt that's essentially solved by those two steps, then I can recall that and I become a little bit, this is a familiar phrase, but a little bit like a drum skin where if somebody is sitting over here and telling me about their feelings and their mistakes and their wounds given to others, I can be really on the same wavelength. We have that. We bring that same amplitude to our exchanges, and it also underlines for me that these are all solvable. That we're not going to. In the later steps, we say we continue to take personal inventory, and when you are wrong, promptly admitted it. That couples right neatly with the eighth and ninth steps, and gives me the proof, if you will, that these work not only on the past, but on the present. So those are, I guess that's a mixed way of picking a favorite.
Did you ever have an amends that didn't go very well, or maybe you thought it didn't go well and it turned out to have gone exactly the way it was supposed to?
Well, I did in a very sad way, David, thank you. My second wife stood by me when I was in the hospital and put up with all of my blackouts and drunkenness. And then when it came time for an effective eight to ninth step, I wrote it down and called her, and I could not reach her. And I hired a detective to find her, at least find her address so I could write her, which is the second best way to conduct a ninth step, given the unavailability of the person, as our book tells us, and the 12 and 12 talks a lot about this. I got her location and I sent a letter. Her phone wouldn't answer. And I sent her a letter registered, and I never heard back. And by the way, I'll tell you, Robert Frost is my favorite of all poets, American and otherwise. Met Frost and sat with him at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1959, and he gave me the inspiration, further inspiration to write, and I've always loved him. So Carol, this is the woman I'm talking about, gave me a book one year for Christmas. And inside it, it said to Jim, who made my life complete, Carol. And I put that book away. It was a favorite book of Frost. And I put it away. And about 4 years ago, I took that book down just random, looking for something I was writing about Frost. And I looked at that inscription and I thought, I tore that woman's life apart. Come on. And this is what the book talks about when it says the love and compassion of wives is beyond anything. I can't remember the exact quote to it, but it goes beyond anything. And so, and this is true, and it was true of her, and it's true of our families and our spouses and so on in large degree. And about a month later, I got an email from an insurance guy, an insurance settlement guy in Denver, wanted to know if I was married to Carol Engel at one time. And I contacted him and said, yes. He said, well, I'm trying to trace a IRA fund that she had and trace her relatives. And I said, well, I can't help you. I don't think I'll give it another try. But I said, would you be able to give me her contact information? He said she died a year ago. And so that struck a new note of sorrow for never having been able to face her as I did the wife of my daughter in a night step I'll never, ever forget in Chicago. Never forget that. It was a magnificent experience, painful for her, but healing for both of us. And, but yeah, that was a real sorrow, David.
Well, you know, I actually know there's several people in the room right now who have sort of amends that aren't possible. So I wonder, how do you get to a place of peace or acceptance, not actually being able to?
Yeah, that's when we have a heart full of desire and willingness, you know, that willingness is on, there are two facing pages of the book where willingness is mentioned seven times. And so we need that. When we have the willingness to make that eighth and ninth step, it's very frustrating when we can't find the person to or persons to whom that ninth step should be addressed. I had that experience, David. My commanding officer in Norfolk was a marvelous man by the name of Merle McBain, Commander Merle McBain. He was, a lot of you know what this is. He was a Mustang, enlisted man that came up to be an officer. He was a magnificent fellow. When I was ending my last tour of duty in the Navy, getting ready to go to graduate school, I secured an interview with NBC Radio at Rockefeller Center in New York. I couldn't afford to go there, probably because I spent most of my money on alcohol. He loaned me the money to do it, $50. Now, $50 is a lot of money in those days. This is 1961. I never paid him back. I was visited by one of the other guys who was on our writing staff there to remind me that he was upset that I hadn't even contacted him. And I never paid it back before he died. So the solution is, in that case, for me and with the guidance of my sponsors, is that I had to make what we would call living amends. And I had to target, I don't believe I can make, this is what I tell my fellows, I don't think we can make these in general terms. I think we have to think of them as specific targets for amends. in my own case, I helped somebody else that needed to travel for his career. This doesn't make a lot of difference, but I had the impulse to make it 10 times what Merle McBain had loaned me. I couldn't find his family. I went to the Navy's. I knew he had probably had a grandson, but I couldn't find any trace of him or his people. And it was still painful, but if I had my mind on that actual targeted method of amends, it helped me a lot. And I've tried to do that because I've been fortunate. I've tried to do that elsewhere as well, to remind myself that whatever success that I've had and whatever good, healthy life I've had didn't come from me. It came from God and the blessings of sobriety. So that sort of that's how I mean that, David.
Thank you. I'm thinking back to the 2X, 3X, 2 and all Librium days here, and you're coming to AA. Did your first sponsor find you, or did you find your first? How did you get off the ground with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous?
I was assigned to him by Clancy, his name was Maurice Zolotow, and Clancy told him, he said, "You help this poor bastard." He said, he said, and then he turned to me and said, he always said this. He said, "This is a program of action, Hurley. You got to get into action." Well, anyway, Maurice Zolotow was a writer and a book on celebrities and so on, and John Wayne and Marilyn Monroe and so on and so forth. And he took me under his wing. And here, now look, here was a non-practicing Jew and an ex-communist dealing with a ex-seminarian fallen away Catholic. Now you'd think they're never going to join the club together. They're never going to, nothing ever going to come from this. But the grace of God, it was like milk and honey with Maurice and I. And I would go to his apartment in Hollywood, and the first time I was there, he handed me this book and he said, "Look, this is our textbook. This is what we study in order to obtain and maintain sobriety." He said, "I know I've been just out of the hospital, really, and I was still terribly sick." And he said, "You just sit here and read this." He was writing a book about John Wayne. He said, "You'll hear me clicking away in the other room." And he said, "So don't worry. Here's some coffee. You get yourself water if you want. I just try to page through this book." And I started to read it. It took me, I think I went there 6 days a week. It took me 2 weeks to finally get to Bill's story. And one day I was sitting there reading, and I still wasn't all in on Alcoholics Anonymous. I still wasn't, I still thought there was an illusion there that it might be, I may need something else to really come up to my caliber of life. And, but I read those three simple, brief, elegant sentences in Bill's story. I was overwhelmed. I had been defeated. Alcohol was my master. That did it. I came into a state of consciousness and recognition that I had never had before. And Maurice's gentle urgings, and I did my first four step with him. It was terrible. I'm sure it was terrible. I finished it in a park near his house trying to impress him. It didn't have as much truth as fiction, and it's fiction in it, and making excuses and so on. But it he really helped me, and then I went on to be sponsored by the most marvelous man I have ever met. I still mourn him. I write about him in a poem in my book, in my new book. And his name was Clint Hodges. And Clint was the most marvelous man. He would take this book and sit across me, and he'd take it and open it up. It was like a river of wisdom came out of it. And he was the Mark Twain of that river. And I have benefited so greatly from him. I was with him when he died. I write this in this poem that he was dying of prostate cancer. And I was putting cool rags on his head. Folks, always go toward death and sorrow. Don't go away from it. Go to the side of it and hold it and put a cloth on it, on the head, or murmur affection and love to that person, and you'll never forget it. You'll be changed in ways that I didn't know, certainly, and you may not have experienced yet. And Clint's cat was on his chest when he took his last breath. And as that breath went out, the cat looked up as if to follow him into his future. I was bereft without him. I still mourn him every day. He's been dead 6 years now, 7 years. And I had the gift of another gift of my current sponsor, Perry Cross, who I told you was 92. But that's how Maurice and I got together, David.
Thank you. You know, this question always comes up with people who've been around for a while. Has the fellowship or Alcoholics Anonymous changed over the years in, I don't know, positive ways, maybe not so positive ways? What do you see today that you don't see anymore?
Well, I'll cite the two opposite sides of your question, David. One of them is that Alcoholics Anonymous, to its great benefit, I think, has become more and more Catholic, small c, meaning that it's universal, that it's everywhere now. And I'm sure some of you have benefited from this. I've been a lot of different places. I was giving talks in Russia one time, and I was in an AA meeting in Russia where weren't supposed to be AA meetings, and in Jakarta, Indonesia, and so on. And I think that's a great benefit to us because we have that tap root, that touchstone every place we go. So that's a biggie. The one not so good, to be candid with you, is that we don't study the history of Alcoholics Anonymous to know what those people felt like and what it must have been like to touch the foundation stone of a program that would eventually lead to the recovery of millions of people. By the way, so that's not so good. We had in our book study about 2 years ago, a fellow came in new, and he was asked to participate after the reading. And he said, well, you know, this is all well and good, but he said, this material was written a long, long time ago. And of course, a lot of it doesn't apply. Well, see, that's what I'm talking about, is that it does apply in ways that are more manifest by AA's growth than we could have known back in Bill and Bob's day. They're both sides of it, but I would say, David, on balance, that the the positives are far outweigh the negatives.
Thank you. As usual, it's been a quick 90 minutes. I hope it has for you. We're nearing the end of our time. We might not get to all the questions, but I got to ask you this one. Jim, how do you recognize this illusion of control, and how and what replaces it?
Well, I guess the best way to say it is, where am I looking for my power? Clinton always used to say, I'd come in and harangue about some issue, you know, somebody was unfair to me, or somebody that made me mad, and he'd say, or somebody didn't do what they promised to do, and he'd say, well, Jim, he said, nobody, I'm disgusted by this. He says, nobody should ever disappoint Jim Hurley, as if to say, you know, that's such inward thinking that it's you know, it's unproductive. And I think a question to ask every day is, where am I getting my power? And I think whether you're 30 days or 3 days, or whether you're new or you come back or whatever it is, I think that's a good question to ask. And I think the impulses of exposure that come from an exposure to sobriety, meetings, 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 sponsor, 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 those will be the conduit for us to know instinctively whether we're thinking alcoholically or whether we're thinking with an eye toward the guidance and grace of a higher power, whether we're in beauty or joy, or whether we're in deep sorrow or sickness. I think I saw somebody here that might be sick earlier, and I send you my extreme best. If any of you are sick or hurting, I've been there too. It's a pain in the rear end. It's part of life. I don't mean to minimize it in any sense.
Thank you. Any of your kids or grandkids in 12-step programs?
No, they're not. Not yet. In my view, they could still use it anyway. One of them's a rock, grunge musician or something. The other one's this or that. I always want them to be what I want them to be. I love them to death. My daughter, however, lives with a man who's an alcoholic, and he's an awfully good man. He takes wonderful care of her, and one of my grandsons is autistic, and this man has taken that boy he's 21 now, but he will never function as a normal adult, whatever normal is, he's taken her in and so on, but he's alcoholic, almost without a doubt, and he said he was, so I can label him. We've had talks out here on the front patio on many, many Father's Days when they come down from Tacoma, but he can still handle it. Those are his words. I can still control it. I can still handle it. So he has the same illusion of control that yours truly kept and cherished for so long, but it's useless.
Oh, thank you. We're going to have to end there, I'm sorry to say. I'd like to thank everybody who participated tonight, for Larry for wrangling the questions, and home group members for co-hosting, and all of you who just showed up. Brian, if you're still here, I'm glad you're here. Hope you picked up some numbers. Feel free to stick around after the meeting. We'll get a chance to thank Jim again after the Lord's Prayer. And I'm going to share my screen and ask if Harmony would read a vision for you. And as usual, I have not allowed everyone to unmute yet.
I got it. It's unmuted.
Thank you.
No problem. I'm Harmony. I'm an alcoholic. A Vision for You, Big Book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit him, your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past and give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit and you will surely meet some of us as you charge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, Harmony. Thank you all. And let's virtually circle up. Virtually hold hands and actually pray the Lord's Prayer. Feel free to unmute. We'll do the Jimi Hendrix feedback version of the Star Spangled Banner with all the feedback and noise. It's just going to be confusing and wonderful. Moment of silence, please. Our Father.
Our Father.
Who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name.
Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses,
as we forgive those who trespass against us.
And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Ah, thank you, Jim. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, my pleasure. It's a joy to be with you. Good reading, Harmony. And thanks, Jim. God bless you and keep you, everybody. And I hope we'll get a chance to see each other impress the flesh one of these days. But if we don't, we'll find each other on the happy road to destiny down the line here. And it's just been a joy to be with you.
Thank you.
Jim, can I ask you, did your brother and Miss Houlihan ever marry?
I'm sorry, dear?
Did your brother and Miss Houlihan get married?
God bless you for asking that question. No, and I'm glad they didn't. It would have deepened my resentment of him. No, they didn't. He went on to marry someone else and had a good life. He died 12 years ago of a deadly form of thyroid cancer. And one of my other brothers was sober. Thank you. One of my other brothers was sober 15 years, died of 11 years ago of he was a Vietnam vet and he died of a related disease. But anyway, then my sister couldn't stay sober and was found slumped over her kitchen table with her favorite peach brandy in front of her. That was about 11 years ago. But anyway, it's a deadly illness but it has a solution. I'm so sorry, I have to go on here. I'm so pleased to be with you and thank you for giving me the best day of the week.
Oh, it was an absolute joy to have you, a privilege.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
All right, good night, Jim.
Thank you, David, and all the readers.
Good to see you, Nancy.
Good to see you, David. Good night. God bless.